Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, June 17th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we've got important events to talk about in money and markets, great questions and ask Catherine, and then a rich discussion about the Gulf oil spill with Jim Norman, veteran reporter and author of The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. No movie tonight. We're going extra time. The conversation is that important. If you haven't listened to Jim's incredible interview earlier this year on his book, The Oil Card, it's wonderful background for the discussion tonight, so I really encourage you to listen to that as well if you haven't had the opportunity. I hope you can stay with us for the full time. If not, just remember you can pick up the MP3 and what you missed tomorrow at the Card. Before we start, a very important note. I've had many requests for a transcript for the Carnicom interview, and our wonderful Mike Linton, who's helping me as a production assistant this summer on his vacation from teaching at Middle Tennessee State University, has transcribed a part one, which is the first hour and 23 minutes of the special interview we did with Clifford. It is now a link posted at the Card under that that interview, and I really encourage you to get it. I said last week that if you want to share that with family and friends and anybody who you think would be interested in learning more about the Soleri Report and what we do, I encourage you to do so. I think it's very useful information to help us understand what is happening and the actions we can take to really protect ourselves and those we love. So Clifford Carnicom, first part one interview is up, and we hope to get part two up by the end of the month. Our theme tonight is one of my favorite quotes from the Buddha. You've heard me use it before. Karma means you don't get away with anything. And what we're watching in the Gulf oil spill and in many of the situations that I'm going to mention tonight, we're watching the what happens when you try, when you practice denial, when you don't deal with issues, when you try and push problems out into the future. They have a way of sort of circling back around and slapping you upside the face, as some of my relatives would say here. And we're watching a facing up to things, whether we like it or not. It's a karma. And it's something that's going to affect us all, because we're all part of this, no matter what our point of view is, no matter what our actions have been. The way you get power in a situation is you take responsibility. And in one form or another, we're all directly or indirectly responsible for some of the events going on. There's also a separation happening where you're seeing people really withdrawing. There's, for a long time, many of us have kind of been in the middle of the road between what is really beginning to look clearly like good and evil. And the middle of the road is getting divided up, and people are separating out one way or another. So that's part of what we're seeing. Money and markets. The money and markets this week, markets were really a lesson in the slow burn. One of the keys to the slow burn, I put a wonderful chart up on the blog this today, which shows the industrial production that relates to both, number one, business, and number two, defense and space. And what you see is literally the extent to which the business of war and space exploration is really taking over the economy. Very interesting turn with 2001, you can see it. But also in the last several years, since 2008, business is dropping and defense and space. And that's really government contracts taking over the economy. Great chart as a background to what we're seeing in the stock market, because often you've heard me say so much of the stock market is being held up with government contracts and government purchases. So let's look at what's behind the stock market really holding its high wire act. Free financing, the central banks continue to hold rates down, indications that the Federal Reserve intends to provide insiders with literally borrowing at near 0% for the foreseeable future. Media control, a very interesting event. Senator Lieberman of Connecticut proposing legislation to give the president what's called now a kill switch on the Internet. Now, that's a very interesting indication that that people are really voting with their eyeballs and shifting from the controlled media to the uncontrolled media. But remember, it's much easier to price markets, to manage prices and markets when you can manage reality. Global capital controls, two interesting developments. The Swiss, finally, the lower house approved the UBS deal. It really is one of the important signals of the end of privacy. And then article I posted on the blog this week, the FAA is now considering how to introduce drones for government agencies and law enforcement purposes throughout the United States, pointing to the success of using drones in Afghanistan and Iraq, basically a war zone. The idea of bringing them into the United States is both chilling and a real issue for airspace. It's a tremendous safety issue, but it's much easier to do backdoor capital controls when you have drones sort of flying overhead across the United States. Very chilling. The bond market, we saw U.S. deficits hit new highs, Treasury, all sorts of notes about what that means to Treasury and Treasury issuance. Part of that was defensiveness of the continued cost of Eurasian wars. General Petraeus fainted on Tuesday. We had congressional testimony on the fact that the Afghanistani war and occupation is now the longest official war in U.S. history. When he was being asked about the length of the stay and strategies, he fainted, attributing it to not having breakfast. In the meantime, and this was the topic of much merriment, and we laughed so as not to cry, an announcement that the Army has identified over $1 trillion worth of gold, lithium, and other natural resources to be mined in Afghanistan. For those of us who have worked in corporate finance on Wall Street, it's a pretty shocking play. If a mining company ever announced forward a huge amount of assets in a find in that manner, they and their executives might find themselves, or their executives might find themselves going to jail. There are very strict rules about pumping up securities with those kinds of announcements. It's really proof that the 10b-5 disclosure laws do not apply to U.S. Treasury securities. But it certainly did seem to succeed for a while in mitigating the sting of the costs of war, unfortunately. Greek bonds were downgraded to junk status. We now have, with a new financial reform, the rating agencies very much under the regulatory control of the U.S. government and really not in a position to avoid playing the game. And so given what happened on the mortgage securities, given now that they're part of sort of the economic hits, it's hard to imagine what ratings mean these days, but they're becoming increasingly political, which is, again, not good for the markets. The dollar continues strong. It's fallen off a little bit. Gold hitting new high today. Silver's still about 50 cents away from the December high. So we continue to have this sort of holding things together, and the slow burn is alive and kicking. I just mentioned my sort of the one newsletter that's always on board for the slow burn is the Kiplinger letter. Comes out every Friday from Washington. Here's what Kiplinger says. What's ahead for the U.S. economy? Relapse into recession isn't likely. Regaining the robust economic health of a few years ago is still far off. They attribute the success to a pickup in productivity gains. Basically what this means is firms lay off people, and that's good for corporate income, and rock-bottom interest rates. So prediction that the slow burn will continue. In the mortgage market, Fannie and Freddie continue to ask for aid. We saw on Wednesday the Federal Housing Finance Agency order Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to delist from the stock exchange, from the National Securities Exchange. This is a big development. You've had a real effort in Washington on the part of some to arrange for the reprivatization of Fannie and Freddie. That's really what you need in neighborhoods on the ground. In fact, you need Fannie and Freddie to go away and not have centralized and government mortgage finance. Unfortunately, there is so much fraud at this point in those portfolios, it's hard to imagine how you could privatize without delinking the bonds from the mortgages. But if you look at what needs to happen on the ground, you need real local and place-based resolutions along with other debt, both private debt and public debt, and really a reengineering of government money. So in those two portfolios, you see the real tension between what securities holders need and what servicers need on the ground. And that's the tension that's going to have to get worked out in our economy if we're ever going to see any real improvement. The municipal bond market has been surprisingly quiet given the problems with the state and local government budget balancing that has to occur. This summer, we see the president arguing for $30-plus billion funds to send to the states for essential purposes, and my guess is there's a lot going on in the back door. In the municipal bond market, most bonds have a certain amount of reserves behind them. The revenue bonds have reserve funds. The general obligations usually have a variety of surplus reserve or fund reserves. And so it's not surprising to see real trouble occur before you see defaults. It can take a while. In New York, and this is also up in the blog, the New York has proposed doing a pension fund deal where they sell bonds to the pension fund. That gives them the money to then make a contribution to the pension fund. We had a question at the court about the liquidation of pension funds. This is really it. Whether through the housing bubble, through the commercial real estate, now with these kinds of deals, what we're watching is all the debt that's being used to finance the bubbles is being pushed into the pension funds, and it's really lowering the quality of those assets. Finally, I call this the philanthropy is the ultimate insult. We saw Gates and Buffett targeting a new sort of campaign encouraging billionaires to pledge to give away 50% of their assets. And I have, as those who know me know, I have a real I have a real bugaboo for the sort of the philanthropy game. You used to see it in communities when you'd bring in the drugs and then you'd bring in the arms. And you'd run the drugs and the war on drugs and bring in the mortgage fraud to launder the drug money, completely harvest the neighborhood, and then it was all over. You'd bring in a tiny bit of your profits back in the form of philanthropy and say, we are here to help you. And it was sort of the last way you could buy away the young people and the talent in the community and devastate the sort of responsible, hardworking people. So it was sort of the coup de grace of the beatdown. Gates and Buffett have been on Charlie Rose and in the press promoting this idea. And here's my feeling, because I'm a great believer in the importance of basics, especially on economic issues. It is so much more important to run a business ethically and to run it in a way which is good for the greater system than to run it in a way that drains and destroys the greater system and then take a portion of your profits and head off and do good work, especially when while you're doing that good work, you're sheltering that capital from taxes. And, in fact, if you look at what you're putting into the good works, it's less than you would be paying in taxes. And, in fact, the good works you're doing are really promoting an agenda that is not good works as it seems. So, for example, the Gates Foundation had a big position in BP stock, which helped the world more. What Gates was giving his money to, or if he turned around and told BP to just run the business on a sound basis. So there's if you look at the fundamental model of foundations in this country, there's enormous embedded hypocrisies. The Gates Foundation is one of the leaders in promoting GMO seeds around the world and vaccines. And then if you look at where their endowment is invested, what you're really doing is you're protecting a huge amount of capital to funnel it back into the pro-centralization team, or some would call the New World Order, while your grants are promoting those policies. So it's a little bit like serving people up poison for dinner and then thinking you can make up for it by giving them a fancy dessert. And so these are guys that I don't look to inform great philanthropy. To their credit, what they did was they encouraged people to give it in whatever way they wanted, wherever they wanted. But let's see what goes on in the back doors. I have to say, if I was the people sitting in the Gulf of Mexico listening to a group of billionaires talk about, you know, how groovy and exciting philanthropy makes them feel and how much opportunities there is while I sat in the Gulf and watched my businesses die and my wildlife die, I would have to say that the people of the Gulf have handled it with remarkable grace. And in our category of heroes this week, I would like to name them, and also Michael Frazier, Chairman, President, and CEO of Simmons & Company in Houston, and his senior partners for firing the Chairman Emeritus, Matt Simmons, founder of the firm, who was shorting stocks while promoting some pretty fearsome descriptions of what was going on with BP. If you know the history of Matt Simmons' activities in the peak oil area, all I can say is it's one less fraudster to listen to. Some great questions and ask Catherine. I'm going to defer the ones for Jim to our discussion with him. There was a question about rating of the pension funds. It's a serious concern. One of the questions was, could you move money into gold money through Entrust, and this is with respect to IRAs, I assume. The answer is yes. However, as you rightly say, if you're a U.S. citizen and any law passed with respect to a U.S. citizen will be respected by any foreign financial institution, and if anything, the announcement this week by the Swiss that they're going to honor the UBS deal with the Department of Justice and the IRS is and the U.S. government is proof of that. One question, I work for NASA, and they've blocked access to Solari.com from their network. We have no idea why that might be. We called and emailed and are waiting for a reply. I often post pictures and articles from the NASA website about space exploration because I think it's a very important topic and one that doesn't get enough coverage. So I really try and link and draw from the NASA website. I will say this, that the history of NASA is deeply entwined, believe it or not, with HUD and mortgage fraud. The HUD was financed by the Appropriation Committee. It's called for 21 agencies. It's Treasury HUD, and it includes NASA. And there was constant war between the space station and section housing, but NASA was one of the agencies that was missing $500 billion as part of the $4 trillion missing money that I'm always squawking about. And the only thing I can think of, if I've done anything to offend NASA, is to point out that their budgets don't balance and to ask where the money's going. And as you all know, I think a lot of the money's gone to space exploration. A comment on cell tower and you're leaving Tennessee. I had published an article several weeks ago called Planet Ford that explained I was planning on leaving Hickory Valley. I'm in the process. I have three properties here, putting them up on the market. There was a large opportunity cost to being in Hickory Valley. It's a lot of what's going on in the world of investment, a lot of just friends and people that living in a rural community that's relatively remote sort of takes me out of the flow of a lot of things, including that in Middle Tennessee where there's a lot going on that I'm connected to. And I was here during a phase where I was starting and building the different parts of our business, the Solari Report, Solari Investment Advisory Services, and now we've just launched the Precious Metals Dealership. And so when you're in the beginning internal phase, it's not a bad time to be in remote places. Now, the advantage of being here was I was next to family, and there's a beautiful spirit here because it's a very rural area. It's out of the way. It's small. The cell towers coming in and the type of development that's coming with them has really removed those advantages, which kind of leaves me with the disadvantages. And I should note that I believe the cell towers are going to be dangerous both to health and sort of general intelligence. And so I'm working to schedule someone who's an expert on cell towers and what they may do to health and sort of the spirit of a place. And hopefully we'll have that scheduled by the fall. I anticipate keeping my home base in Hickory Valley, which is I'm in West Tennessee near Memphis, until I sell the properties, which could take a while. And then I'll either move to mid-Tennessee near Hohenwald or, you know, we'll just see because that may take a while. I don't anticipate for the foreseeable future leaving Tennessee. My home base will be here. What I will be is I'll be out on the road a lot more, particularly for the Soleri report. I'll be in Montana in August. I'll be in Silicon Valley from September 15th to November 15th and in Philadelphia through the New Year's. Then in 2011, I'm hoping to be able to do more Soleri reports from Asia and Latin America and Europe. And I think that the message of what happened here in Hickory Valley is that as change accelerates, we have to be ready to shift with it. And there is a separation going on. The Hickory Valley is really going one way, and I'm going another. I want to be part of something that's very based in organic food, and Hickory Valley continues to go more to genetically modified food, et cetera. And I think that's happening to a lot of us, and so we're all seeking ways I said to Franklin Sanders today, I said, we all seem to kind of want to find each other and get in one place. And he said, oh, great, they can take us out with one bomb. So we're sprinkled around for now. So I'm just going to be out about a lot more. Question on sugar addiction. I talked about finally being able to break the sugar addiction, and someone asked me what was it that worked. We are working to schedule what I believe is one of the top experts in the country in the United States on sugar addiction. In a nutshell, here's what happened to me. I did two things. First, despite trying many things that weren't working, I watched every DVD I could find that would help inspire me to do so. And one of the ones, I've pretty much put them all up on the blog and had them in the Soleri report, but one of the ones that was very inspiring for me was Killer at Large, because you just see how dangerous the food is. Second, a subscriber gave me a formula that worked for me, and everyone's different, so I just caution you. One rule was, okay, it's three rules: no sugar, no agave nectar. I was using agave nectar. That was part of the problem. I can have a little bit of honey. I can have as much whole fruit as I want, and it's okay to have organic coffee in the morning. That combination just worked like a charm. But everybody's different. In the questions, we have a subscriber pointing to a retreat or a gated community they're working on in East Tennessee. Looks beautiful. I wanted to just mention it to you. Lakeview Village in Kingston, Tennessee, and their website is Lakeview Village TN for Tennessee. You might want to check it out. Okay, lots of good questions about the oil spill, and so I'll address them when I talk with Jim, and it's now my pleasure. I just have to say before I bring Jim in, you all have heard his resume before. He's a veteran business journalist. He writes for McGraw-Hill, Hills Platts Oil Graham News. He's been a senior editor at Forbes magazine and Business Week, where he was Houston bureau chief. He's won awards for investigative reporting, and his book, The Oil Card, it's just a must-read. It's on my list of the top 10 books you need to read to understand the economy. But I called Jim at his home on Tuesday and talked, I don't know how long, then got on the phone with him today, and each time I talk to him, I just can't stop talking to him because he just knows so much about what's going on. So, Jim, it's my pleasure to welcome you back to the Soleri Report.
Thanks for having me back on, Catherine.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, but maybe if we could start before the spill, and you could just give us a little introduction to BP and the offshore drilling, the specific property and lease that is now part of the spill, and just give us some background and context on what was happening right before the accident and what this looked like before this all started.
Okay, well, let me see if I can just jump into this. Everybody's heard a lot about this well already, and I'll try not to cover ground that everybody's already heard. But this well it's a place called Mississippi Canyon, Block 252. It's like 40 miles or so offshore Louisiana. It's part of what's called a tertiary trend, which is where BP and a bunch of other companies have found lots and lots of oil in deep waters. This is like 6,000 feet deep, 5,000 or 6,000 feet deep in the Gulf of Mexico.
So that's a mile straight down.
Yep. And then they drilled from the ocean floor down another 18,000 feet or so to where they found this formation, which BP officially has described it. They estimated the reserves found would be like 50 million barrels. That's what Tony Hayward, the CEO, testified today in Congress. But companies usually tend to lowball those estimates early on, and then they ramp them up, revise them upwards down the road. So I think it's safe to say there's a lot more oil there than that, as well as gas. And some people who have looked at the geology say that this is part of a trend that reaches all the way up under Alabama. So if it's all connected, you could have had a very massive oil and gas structure there. BP was drilling this well, though, with what looks like just a whole raft of careless, corner-cutting, penny-pinching, stupid, dangerous decisions that they made along the way. It was a troubled well. It was running over budget, over time. You know, they spend $1 million a day or so drilling a well like that, and every day that the rig is there, it's costing them a lot of money. So clearly there was a rush to get this well finished and temporarily plugged in so the rig could move off it, and therein created a whole series of just tragic, catastrophic problems right at the end there. And neither BP nor the contractor, Transocean, or the other contractors on this well have covered themselves in glory in this thing. I mean, you've got 11 people dead. You've got a $500 million rig that's sunk on the bottom of the ocean. You've got the most horrendous oil spill going on that this country has ever seen offshore. It's just a colossal mess, and the price tag is that meter is spinning madly here, which is going to get us into some very interesting financial ramifications not too far down the road. We'll talk about that later. Let's see. What else can I start?
Now, BP has a history of sort of bad management and safety problems.
Well, yes. In fact, I've covered the oil industry for a long time for Platts, and before that for Forbes and Business Week. And I have to say that as much as you might hate a lot of these big oil companies, BP rather distinguished itself in having chronically inadequate and ethically challenged management, which is rather breathtaking for a company that's of that size and prominence, that it wouldn't be better run. You know, for the last more than a decade, the company was run by now Sir John Brown, a very shrewd, astute financial guy who was hounded out of office at BP for his questionable personal life and financial shenanigans that were going on there. He left under a terrible cloud, but my impression is that the damage he did was profound to the company, and that I think he surrounded himself with rather lackluster managers, sycophants, if you will, that have kind of permeated all the upper ranks of management at BP. And I think that that's coming home to roost with them now. In fact, I think one of the things that may be keeping Tony Hayward, the current CEO, in his job right now is that BP doesn't really have much depth on its bench of other people who could step in and do that job with credibility. So it's hard to say it would be a great improvement if he were asked to take a hike right now. They'd probably keep him around, although I think eventually you're going to see a wholesale turnover and further clearing out of BP management. By the time this is over, this company is not going to look much like it did in the past. We'll talk about the financial restructuring. I think we'll accompany that soon as well.
Now, what if we were to go to the, you know, dive down a mile to the floor of that property now, what is happening? how much oil is coming out, and what's really going on in terms of the physical nature of what's happening.
Right. Now, much of this is a mystery. Much of it is conjecture. BP has not been particularly forthcoming, although they have revealed some key details of what seems to have happened here. What you can see on their remote cameras down there is a huge amount of black stuff coming, billowing out of this huge pipe sticking out of the ocean floor there. The rate at which it's pouring out now, there's a great debate about that. Current estimates are anywhere from like 25,000 barrels a day to 60,000 barrels a day of oil and natural gas, but I think that's the oil amount in there. You have natural gas that's in there as well, which gives it kind of a brownish color. When the natural gas hits very cold, very high-pressure water, it actually turns into a kind of rock-like ice called hydrates, where the methane actually formed a lattice with water molecules. And you see these little white flecks flying around there. That's like ice, and that collects down there on the ocean floor. When the well blew out, a blowout, it's really, in this case, what happened was they let the pressure of the drilling fluids in the well fall to the point where the pressures of the gas and oil down below in the formation, which is like 12,000 pounds per square inch, just pushed all that stuff up the pipe and up the what's called the riser. That was this umbilical that connects the wellhead with the drilling rig above. It pushed all that drilling fluid, which they call it mud, pushed it all the way up out of the well, all the seawater that they'd put in there. And then it was followed by this torrent of natural gas, much of which might have actually been in liquid form, blew up under the rig, smothered the rig deck in flammable stuff, and it was just moments before it caught fire, burned the rig, sank the rig. The rig wasn't able to disconnect from the well, and as a result, just had to sit there over this burning pool of gas underneath it until the rig eventually structurally failed and sank. That's part of the problem, is that the riser is supposed to be able to separate from the well. It didn't. That actuator failed some way. And that's one of the many mechanical problems with this thing. The other big problem everybody talks about is what's called the BOP, the blowout preventer, which is this about a 300, 400-ton piece of machinery that sits on top of the wellhead. It's got a bunch of rams and vices that, if the well had to be closed, these things would hydraulically squeeze shut around any drill pipe that's in there so that things wouldn't be getting out of the well. In this case, the BOP didn't work. The things just didn't actuate properly. The ones that did couldn't close it because apparently there was not just a drilling pipe going through it, but there was some other pipe in there too. Nobody's explained what that is really. I think it was some lost measurement tooling that was sitting down in the well. It must have got blown up, stuck in the blowout preventer, so they couldn't close these rams around it to shut the flow. So you had this initial flow coming up through the blowout preventer, then leaking out through a kink in the busted riser that was laying on the floor. You saw that for a few days. Then they came in, decided to try and go in and push more heavy-weighted mud down into the well through some other valves that they had there. That didn't work. So they gave up on what was called a top kill. Then they just decided to cut off the top of the pipe above the blowout preventer and hang this non-pressurized collection scoop to try and just kind of snarf up as much of this oil and gas as they could, which has been recovering, I think they're up to, well, like 15,000 barrels a day through that and maybe another 5,000 barrels a day now through another recovery system that they just started using. So
if 60 are coming out, they're getting back 20.
Yeah. Actually, I think the actual flow is probably more like 30,000 barrels a day. I don't think it's actually up to 60.
Okay.
But even so, 30,000 is a lot. It means there's 10,000 barrels a day just going into the drink there.
Right.
Now, part of the reason that BP stopped pumping mud into the well in this so-called top kill effort was because there's been an, and BP has admitted to this, that there's some kind of a downhole problem in that pipe, in the pipe that's in the subsea area, about 1,000 feet down. There's some kind of a kink or crack or fracture in the pipe itself, which means that the mud that they were pumping down that well was leaking out of the well bore into the rock around it some way. Well, this is very bad news. And it also means that the oil and gas coming up from the bottom, that's leaking out too. And what happens is when it gets out of the well bore, it goes looking for soft rock or permeable rock that it can flow into. And part of the problem in drilling in the Gulf of Mexico is that the rocks down there are not that hard. It's rather unconsolidated mush, really. It's just layer upon layer of sediment that is built up and built up, but it's not like igneous rock formed by volcanic activity. It's just kind of loose mud stacked up. And when you start pushing very hot fluids into that stuff, I mean, this it's about 260 degrees at the bottom of that hole. When that stuff starts flowing into these unconsolidated rock or layers as you get towards the ocean bed, the stuff fills up and pressurizes, yes, but it also can turn into like mud and just turn into tapioca, as it will. And so what you could end up with here, and this is the big concern, is that the upper layers there could just become so soft, so mushy, that the oil and gas could escape outside of the pipe altogether and just bubble to the surface around the well.
Is that why they keep referring to the fear of a volcano?
Yeah, that it would be what would amount to a kind of an oil and gas, well, call it a volcano bay. Think of it like at Yellowstone. It's not the volcano, but it would just be like a hot spring coming up there where you've got
right.
The stuff just flowing unrestricted into the ocean. And there were some videos from one of the remote operated vehicles for a while that kind of seemed to indicate that. You could see it was looking at the mud floor around the well, and you could see these little white flecks of hydrates popping up off of the ocean floor. And then you'd see an occasional puff of brownish stuff billowing up. It looks like it would just be burps of oily gas coming up from the ocean floor around the well, which tells you that the well itself, its integrity has been breached, and that there's some overflow. This is why they haven't tried to put a firm cap on the well with a valve that they could just turn it off, because if they did that, they'd be backing up that pressure back down into the well and pushing more of it out into the
formation. So it'd make it worse.
What happens then, imagine this, you've got this 400-ton blowout preventer sitting on top of the well. It doesn't really reside on anything solid on the ocean floor. It just sits on the well. Now, at the top of this well, you've got the there's a pipe in which the oil and gas was supposed to be coming up. Then it's surrounded by some concentric strings of other casing that they put in toward the top. And then they put cement in between those spaces, between the different diameter rings, which are called the annuli, or it's an annulus between these two layers of pipe. At the top, it's filled with cement. Nothing's supposed to get through there. But so the BOP sits on, actually, this set of pipes that are sitting there, all heavily cemented. Well, what happens is if the surrounding rock turns into mush, pretty soon what you've got is it's like a bowling ball sitting on a soda straw here. And you would have a problem potentially of the whole upper part of the well toppling over. In fact, I was intrigued that for a while there, one of the remote operated vehicles, the camera was focused on an inclinometer. It's like a like a bubble level you'd have on a, you know, just to see if something's level. This is on the BOP, and it seemed to be indicating that there was already some tilt going on with the BOP. So this is why BP had to stop with the top kill effort and let the thing flow, because if they started putting much more pressure down into the well, you could exacerbate.
It could blow sideways.
Yeah, you'd blow sideways, the thing would topple over, there'd be, it would greatly complicate the fixing of this thing. And so what they've had to do is make the best of it, collect what they can of this stuff, and hope that these two relief wells that are being drilled will get there in time to intercept the pipe way down below, pump heavy mud and cement into the well down below to kill it down there before the you have that erosion around the top of the well and you get an unconsolidated volcano or hot spring effect going on. So,
one of the questions before we go into the relief well is, I read that BP might have drilled into a magma core, opening a fissure in seafloor. Is that possibly true?
I don't think that's true. Not at that depth, I don't think. You'd have to go a lot deeper to get to that kind of stuff. No, I think this is just a very highly pressurized, a very rich pay zone that they got to. There's all kinds of weird stuff on the internet, and I caution people. Some people say, oh, this well was drilled to 35,000 feet. That's baloney. It's nothing like that happened.
Right.
There's people, Matt Simmons, talking about, oh, there's 40,000 pounds of pressure down there, or 100,000 pounds of pressure. That's ludicrous. The pressure down there, it's about, actually it was measured at just under 12,000 pounds per square inch. By the time it gets to the ocean floor, it's about 6,000. The pressure of the water is about 5,000, so you still got that 1,000 pounds or so of pressure differential that's pushing this stuff out. And it's coming out at a rapid pace, but not the 100,000 barrels a day that people are talking about. I think you're probably talking more like 30,000 barrels a day or so.
Now, you said to me when we talked that you thought the chances of the two relief wells working was not... The odds are not great.
There's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong with these relief wells. Now, the technology is pretty good to actually get the tip of the relief well pretty close or right on to the target down there, even at a depth of, say, 15,000 feet or wherever they're going to intercept it. But they'll probably take several tries. They'll miss the first time, the second time, they'll have to back up every time, and they're drilling. So all that takes time. It also works better, I'm told, if you could have both of those wells working together and to inject fluid into that well to kill it. That would, because one of the risks is that the relief well could blow out too. Imagine this, the relief well gets close to the existing well. The pressures in the existing well
are so great,
blow out the rock and push all of the drilling mud back out of the relief well, and you got a second blowout going
right
on there. So there's definitely risk. Plus, once you get into the cavity of the original well, then you have to mill your way through the steel. Then you need a whole different kind of bit. It takes time. It's rather slow. There's a whole bunch of difficult stuff going on. It's state-of-the-art thing. It's amazing what we can do. Much better than the Russians, who never had that kind of capability, which is why they used half a dozen or so nuclear weapons at various times underground to basically crush pipes on runaway wells that they had.
Right.
Not because that's a good solution, it's because the Russians couldn't drill with the kind of precision needed to intercept the well.
Now, if these two relief wells don't work, does that mean you just try two more?
Yeah. I think,
and you keep doing that until...
Keep doing it until you are able to put enough heavy mud down there to stop this flow.
So in the worst case, how long could this take?
Well, I think even at an optimal case, you're talking late August or early September. If you go with just the first well, if you wait for the second well, you're talking well into September. And then if you have other problems, it could be beyond that. So you're talking I would say mid-late September before you'd be able to, before it's Miller time.
And then if the two relief wells don't work, what are we looking at in terms of the Gulf Coast and the Caribbean and the...
Yeah, well, it's an unmitigated disaster anyway. Look, I mean, a huge amount of this oil has come out of the ground down there. Now, one good thing, I guess, it's light oil, so a bunch of it evaporates. Of course, if they come down as rain somewhere else, and you get
right.
the slimy film on your car and stuff like that, but it, at least it's not killing birds on the shore, but... Then a lot of the other stuff, especially with the use of dispersants, the stuff will basically evaporate or coagulate and sink to the bottom.
Now, you think using the dispersants makes sense?
Yeah, I think they got to do that. Otherwise, it would take much longer to get this stuff to break up. I think as toxic as some of those things may be, I think that it's a necessary trade-off you got to do. To get this stuff broken up. Otherwise, you're going to have this stuff all over pristine beaches all over the place. And it's already starting to show up there, of course.
This sinks it as opposed to letting it go up on the beach. And
yeah, better to have it sink offshore or coagulate in rafts that you could then scoop up with skimmer-type equipment. And I think they're adding more of that. There's still going to be a lot of it hit the shore, although I think maybe not as much as, I mean, it won't be all of the oil coming out of the wellhead for sure. It'll
right.
be some fraction of that. And there's a lot of talk of, it's going to get into the Atlantic, it's going to pollute the whole coast of Florida. No, I think if you look at the way the currents actually work, most of it is going to end up pretty much, I think, along the Louisiana-Alabama border, the Panhandle. And it would coagulate kind of in the armpit there of Florida between the Panhandle and where the peninsula goes south.
Right.
Some of it will get caught up in what's called a loop current or just kind of circle around in a Gulf.
So you think it'll stay in the Gulf and not switch over to the Europe?
I think it'll be small quantities would make it into the Atlantic, and then it would just, I mean, the idea of it actually landing on a beach somewhere, I think, is remote. So I think... the brunt of the problem is going to be along the Gulf Coast. That said, I mean, it's still going to cost probably $1,000 a barrel to clean this stuff up when it hits the beach. Now, that's on top of federal Clean Water Act fines of up to $4,300 per barrel that the U.S. government could levy against BP for violation of the Clean Water Act.
Which means the estimate of what's flowing out has a major impact on BP.
Well, that's right, especially if you're looking at, what's the present value of the liability being created here. BP, I guess you could say, has a vested interest in lowballing the amount of the spill. You could say the government might have an interest in inflating the number some way. You would think that somebody would be trying to measure it accurately, and there's all kinds of experts who supposedly are, but I think they're all kind of guessing at it. Ultimately, I guess it's going to be whatever the government thinks it can prove as to what the leak was, and BP's going to be on the hook for that. Now, let's talk about some of the dollars here. You know, this week, the president... extracted from BP a pledge to fund over a period of several years, actually, a $20 billion fund would be separately administered that would pay claims of people on shore and other people who've been injured by this thing.
That's not the money for the $4,300 per barrel fines.
No.
And that's
no.
just the private.
Right.
Private.
And job losses and all that kind of stuff, which... I suppose, like there's $1 billion a year shrimp business off of Louisiana and things like that. That, say if you give those people a couple of years worth of revenues, that adds into that. You've got tens of thousands of offshore oil workers who are going to be laid off for protracted periods due to the moratorium. They've got a theoretical claim here, too. I mean, everybody's going to line up for some payment out of this. So BP, I think, has probably done itself a favor by just agreeing to put the money into a separate fund, let somebody else worry about divvying it up and paying it out. BP's bigger problem, though, is going to be what it owes the U.S. taxpayer and the government in the form of these fines. And that number is going to get very big. It's probably already $10 billion, could go to $20 billion. Now, if you're the U.S. government and you've got a $20 billion account receivable from this company that's already under severe strain and dubious
management. Right, and to put that in perspective, when this started, their market value was about $200 billion, and about $100 billion of that is now gone.
Yeah, I think it started, it was like $250 billion equity market cap, of which they've now lost going on $100 billion. Of course, the market has come down somewhat with that, but even so, BP's market value loss has been twice what the market correction has been. So it's significant, but I think BP is now trading at a tad over $30 a share. I think it's I wouldn't buy the stock, not at this point. In fact, I think that it could go significantly lower. And in fact, one of the scenarios I have pondered here and have kicked this around with some legal types is at what point would the United States government decide that it needs to actually impose federal receivership over some of these BP assets, particularly BP's deepwater Gulf of Mexico leases.
Alaska. BP is the lead on the Alaskan properties.
Yeah, there's BP's got federal leases all over the place. A lot in Alaska, a lot in the Gulf of Mexico. There would be other federal leases onshore. I mean, you could make a strong case from the taxpayer standpoint that this company is a financial risk, A. It has shown it's irresponsible and unworthy of owning and operating these leases. And so as a collateral basis, all it takes is a showing by the Attorney General that a crime has been committed, and you could use existing forfeiture laws to allow the U.S. government to step in short order, have a federal receiver appointed over these assets. A receiver could then...
seize BP America?
Well, I don't think you would have to go that far. I think you'd probably see selected assets that would cover the liability. But what I think what BP would do, the natural line of defense for a BP would be to put its U.S. operations into a Chapter 11 proceeding as a preemptive move to prevent those assets falling under a federal receiver. The difference there being that a federal receiver is obligated really to serve the interests of the government and the taxpayers. A bankruptcy court or a bankruptcy trustee is really obligated to serve creditors, bondholders, trade creditors, and ultimately shareholders if there's anything left over. And the government claims would be just another class of claims in there that would get paid some pennies on the dollar, presumably from a reorganization. So if BP had its choice, I'm sure they'd much prefer a Chapter 11 than a federal receivership. So you could, you know, if the feds moved for a receiver, you could see a race to the courthouse for BP to file a Chapter 11. And then the stock value would become very problematic. There'd be some, but who knows when.
Well, that's just BP America. I mean, you still have BP.
Well, you'd have the parent, but, I mean, probably 60% of BP's asset value is tied up in BP America.
Right.
And, you know, beyond that, really, BP's production future is tied to these deepwater Gulf of Mexico leases. They've already found huge amounts of oil out there through the wells that they have drilled, but very little of it is actually on production yet. BP has been anticipating production on like 500,000 barrels a day just off some of these Gulf of Mexico leases if they could get the development wells drilled and bring them on stream. I mean, it would be a real blow to BP now if, having screwed up so badly on this well, the government steps in and takes those leases away from them, sells them maybe at fire sale prices to BP's competitors, who the government deems to be, you know, more prudent operators than BP. I mean, it's
Given the management issues that have come out, why not facilitate a takeover?
Well, who would take? This is what I'm saying. That you would. This would be kind of a
poison pill.
As it is now, I don't think you would have a takeover threat because BP's got the classic poison pill right now. Nobody would touch it. What you have to wonder about from a government policy point of view is, you know, do these assets belong in the hands of BP, which has showed itself so badly capable of managing them? What you could do, a federal receiver could take some of these assets, give them to other people. That would leave a rump company. That one might be edible by somebody else. I don't think that the Chinese would be able to get it. It would be similar to the Unocal situation in the United States. I think politically it would not be acceptable, but you could have a much shrunken BP that might get taken up by some other company some way, with many of its key crown jewel assets going to other competitors some way. I mean, you could have a piecemeal, basically government-orchestrated breakup of the company. It's hard to see BP remaining in its current status going forward, partly because it's hard to imagine how BP is ever going to get permitted to drill another well in the Deepwater Gulf in our lifetimes. So right. What does that do to the value of these leases and the discovered reserves they've got out there? They're just going to sit there for a long time. BP is the operator on a number of these very large projects.
One of the things that struck me when you and I first spoke about this was, here you have a company with a market cap of $200 billion plus, and to save money, it's taking risks that could essentially destroy the whole company. So, you know, to save $500,000, you're putting the entire Gulf of Mexico and the entire company at risk.
Right. Well, this gives a lie to Tony Hayward's testimony today under oath that his big focus has been on safety in the company. Well, if that's the case, he's been an abject failure because it just hasn't gotten down into the ranks. The little people, let's call them, who were working down inside BP, rolling the dice on these things, betting the company to save, chump change on a couple of days worth of drilling. I mean, this is lunacy to let a company be run this way. This is why Exxon and Shell and these guys look at BP in just utter astonishment and amazement that the company could let itself get into a mess like this. And again, it goes back to bad management.
I still believe that there's a possibility of sabotage here, and I just don't think we have enough information to be sure it wasn't. But I will say this, everything I've learned about the safety record of BP is so horrible that, you can certainly explain, it certainly could have happened purely from greed and incompetence.
Yeah, and BP has such a rich history of this stuff. I mean, they blew up their refinery at Texas City, killed a bunch of people there. Just the same kind of stupid, careless, thoughtless, penny-pinching stuff going on. You'd think they'd have learned their lesson there. But,
Well, here's what's amazing is the company was making a lot of money and had tremendous cash, was paying a large dividend. So it wasn't as though it was cash poor.
Oh, that's right. No, they were paying a very rich dividend, funding internally all of their massive capital expenditures, and still putting money in the bank. Their debt level is not that high. It's, the mid-20s range.
So there
they
was
were
no,
AA credit before.
They weren't under stress to have to be cheap.
No, not at all. You would think that they would, especially on a well like this, that...
It was so important to the future of the company.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, What amazed me about Hayward's testimony today was how out of the loop he was on this well. It sounds like the only thing he knew about this well, it makes you wonder if he even knew they were drilling it at the time they finally told him, oh, we found oil at Macondo. He probably had to go to a map
well
and find out where
it was important. If you just look at total shareholder value and expected value was so important, you know, this well was so important, how could he not know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, these Deepwater Gulf of Mexico assets, I mean, they were going to be counted on to provide the bulk of BP's oil production growth over the next few years. And, you know, a big question will be how long this moratorium goes on, and then beyond that, how long it will be before BP itself can get back in the action in this Deepwater Gulf, because they need these barrels, or they're going to be shrinking their production base here rather rapidly. And this is where the bigger problem is here. I think that BP's activity here has put a blight
on the whole industry.
Over the most rich, prolific, promising oil province that we've come across in a mighty long time. Look, who now, except for an Exxon or a Shell, and them with great trepidation, would dare drill another well out there now, having seen what can happen? Now,
right.
Yeah, you would have to be so absolutely confident in your technology and your systems and everything else that you know you couldn't have a problem like this again. Nobody can be that confident.
One of the things that has been hardest for me and some of the subscribers to understand is the response. You know, you have governors and parish presidents being kept off land under their jurisdiction. You have whack and hut mercenaries, you know, walking around. You have the Coast Guard telling people they can't come someplace because BP said they can't. And it looks like such a paranoid and, I mean, one of the reasons I thought, well, there must have been sabotage, because if you look at how paranoid they're behaving, it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, we've seen countless people saying, you know, we have all these great ideas to try and prevent the oil coming into the wetlands and other things, and nobody's allowed to try any stuff. It's just, you know, it just feels like the lawyers are running everything.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I think that you have this symbiotic situation here where, you have BP, and the government itself is extremely culpable in much of this. I mean, the behavior of the Minerals Management Service and the Interior Department in basically approving all these flawed well designs, failing to inspect them, signing off willy-nilly on last-minute changes that contributed to this problem. I mean, the government has got egg on its face and mud on its boots all over the place here. So
did you get
you
a chance
see
to read
both
that?
Watching each other's backs here.
Did you get a chance to read the Rolling Stone article?
Oh no, I'm sorry, I haven't read that. But
they describe in detail the MMS and regulatory failures, including the contingency plans for a spill that BP filed, over 500 pages. With lots of references to Alaska and Alaskan wildlife,
yeah,
which
right.
The theory was, they must have cut and pasted their Alaska plan, and nobody at MMS bothered to read it.
Well, that's come out in the congressional hearings. Apparently all the companies basically submitted cookie-cutter plans that all had a lot of the same boilerplate in them. So it's like they were all worthless. I mean, and that's certainly what has proved to be true. You know, in other places, like Norway, when you're drilling a well like this, you have to have a second rig lined up to begin that relief well immediately. You don't have to wait a month to start a relief well the way they did in the Gulf. And there's plenty of rigs out there they could have lined up for that kind of stuff. There's a whole bunch of precautions they could have taken. It's just been sloppy, sloppy, sloppy.
Well, why, as soon as it happened, why didn't they get one?
Well, I think they tried, but then you got to start from scratch to find a rig and get a well designed and then and then.
Right.
And then. So it's like they're inventing the wheel from the get-go. When they should have had this stuff. There should have been a plan in place immediately to get
going. Did they know about the extraordinary pressure? coming into this?
Sure. I mean, they knew exactly what the pressure was when they drilled the well. They knew what the weight of the mud required to keep the stuff down there. So they knew what the pressure was. It was high, but it was manageable. But the trouble was that they were scrimping on the pipe that they put in there. As the well diagrams will show, what the other majors would do, they'd run what's called a liner all the way to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
That's a piece of metal. It's a tube that basically butts up against the outside wall of the rock that you've drilled through. Then you put the production casing down inside that and fill the space, the annulus, with cement. So you've got a really solid blockage there so that there's less risk of oil and gas getting up around the casing and flowing up through the air spaces. And, like, you know, they should cement the whole thing in, you know, be up against the rock so that you don't get that stuff. And then there's a lot of discussion about the spacers. BP hung a rather long string of production casing down there, and what you need to do is put, like, O-rings around that make sure that the pipe stays right in the middle so that when you put the cement in there, you get cement all the way evenly around that to fill in the spaces. But if you let the pipe wobble and lean up against the wall of the other pipe, then you get air spaces, gas can get through there, and, you know, stuff happens. So BP scrimped on the spacers, for God's sakes. And they didn't put enough cement in a hole. They used the wrong kind of cement because they didn't use heavy enough cement. They wanted to use really light stuff. They mixed nitrogen in it so that it wouldn't crack the rock and spoil their ability to produce the well. It was just one bad decision compounded upon another, and then finally, at the end, the whole thing just ran away from them, and 11 people died, the rig sank, and the rest is history.
Was the story about Schlumberger leaving true?
I don't know. That's an interesting anecdote, and we may, hopefully at some point it will come out. Schlumberger, one of the services they do is they do testing of these bottom cement plugs that went into this well. And they had sent a team of people out to that rig to supposedly test the cement down there. Now, what I've read, and nobody quite knows what happened here. Apparently what happened was the head of that crew, Schlumberger field managers, had the authority to pull their people out of a situation if they think it's dangerous. And apparently that's what happened here, that the part of the reason that test was not done is because Schlumberger guy got there, he looked at what are called the mud logs, and he could see that there was gas intrusion into that well from somewhere. It was showing up in the drilling mud that was being circulated back to the rig. He said, this is a problem. There should not be that kind of gas in there. This is a dangerous situation. And supposedly he said, I want you to get me a helicopter and get my people out of here right now. Now, later on, Schlumberger came out with a statement saying that the crew did leave without doing the test, but it was on a regularly scheduled helicopter flight, I think, to basically put to rest the idea that there was some great alarm. On the other hand, if Schlumberger knew there was a problem like this there, didn't tell anybody, well, how culpable are they? I mean, what's right. The moral responsibility if nothing else? I mean, they knew this thing was getting ready to blow and were itching to bug out of there. How come they didn't tell somebody about it? So, I tell you, nobody has covered themselves with glory in this thing. There's ample blame to go all around. Transocean, they let their people caved into the BP guy on the rig who apparently was giving them bad orders because they didn't want to offend their best customer. So they just rolled over and cost them a rig and a bunch of people.
Well, you know, it's funny. Everywhere you turn, and I've seen this ever since the, you know, 94 when this all really got going, and even Iran-Contra before that, you have everybody trying to go along with the system when they know operationally it's nuts, and we keep making political decisions or financial decisions, and you know, that's when I said the karma means you don't get away with anything. You know, it's all catching up, and it's catching up in a lot of places. It's not just in,
right.
You know, in Mississippi Canyon. Another great question we had, Jim, was whether or not this situation is going to educate people to the fact that the peak oil myth may be a myth.
Well, of course, that comes to everybody's mind here, and Obama has kind of fueled that talk as well with his speech. He didn't say peak oil per se, but he got on his bandwagon again about, oh, we got to get off oil, and we got to, you know, go to alternative energy, and we got to have cap and trade and energy bills, blah, blah, blah. To me, the obvious point of this is that there's a heck of a lot of oil down there that we ain't ever gotten to yet that is just there for the taking if we drill the wells right. I mean,
right.
And by the way, how do you get oil at 18,000 feet below a mile deep ocean? This is dinosaur bones? I don't think so. I mean, I think there's got to be a significant amount of plausibility to the idea that hydrocarbons are generated from within the earth, and they tend to migrate upwards until they find permeable layers where they can collect and cook for a while more. My view is that the earth is it's a gigantic grinding mill inside, and so you have all kinds of light elements forever percolating up to the top. I mean, otherwise, how is it that you find helium underground? How do you find carbon dioxide in huge quantities underground? So as hydrogen, carbon, these other gaseous elements migrate upward, run into hydrogen, run to the carbon deposits somewhere, or they just get trapped together and cooked into longer hydrocarbon chains, that's where oil comes from, you know? And
right.
Natural gas is just methane. That just doesn't get cooked into a long enough chain. So the idea that the Earth has a finite amount of hydrocarbons that are going to run out any day now, it doesn't work that way. And in fact, if you look at the history of the industry, the main quintessential problem the oil industry has always had is not getting oil out of the ground. It's how to keep enough in the ground so you don't trash the price.
Right.
We will run out of oil demand long before we run out of oil.
That's why I really want everybody to go back and listen to the first interview we did.
Yeah. So
and they should all read your book.
There you go. Which is now in Kindle form, by the way, if you don't want to carry around dog-eared paperback copy.
Well, I'll never forget sitting at dinner and reading that Exxon's finding cost was $4 a barrel, and I think the price at that time was over 100.
No, their finding cost was only about 50 cents. It was their and development cost was only $4 a barrel.
It was $4.
Yeah,
but that didn't include refining.
No, but that included all the cost of drilling the wells, putting the platforms out there, and the pipelines to get it on shore. That's only $4 a barrel, and they were selling it for, what, $140 at one point, I guess.
Now, you know, one constituency here is the shareholders. Because you're talking about a stock that was, you know, people bought it for its dividend, and people held it for decades. And, in fact, if you look at the shareholdings, one of the biggest holders as a category was employees and former employees. And BP had bought a whole series of companies. You had mentioned Amco, you know, and swap stock. Those were stock deals.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all these people who really – in their retirement, they're depending on that dividend.
And yeah, that's true. And, you know, it's worth noting that although it's a UK-domiciled company, actually a majority of the shares are owned by U.S. individuals and institutions ever since they did the Amoco and Arco deals. I mean, it's a British company really in name only. Probably 60% of their assets and their income comes from the U.S.
But I would note that Goldman Sachs miraculously sold 43% in the first quarter of their holdings.
They're smart guys. Yeah. it's good living. You know, they're living right. They get lucky. It's karma. Okay.
They're doing God's work.
Exactly.
They we put a brand index up on the blog, and it shows that, that today, despite everything, Goldman Sachs' brand is still lower than BP's.
Well, pot's calling kettles black, I guess. They go together.
One of the most remarkable things to me is I picked up the paper this morning, and BP's had, I believe, two dividends so far this year. They paid one, and they announced the second.
But they rescinded it.
Jim, I've never, in all my years in banking and investment banking, I've never heard of a company rescinding. I'm sure it's happened, but I've never heard of it.
Well, this is what makes me wonder, what was the real
threat
going on here that made BP cave into this $20 billion fund? I think it was that they were told in no uncertain terms, either you voluntarily put this $20 billion into this fund and eliminate your grossly embarrassing dividend, or else you're going to find yourself in a federal receivership, which you're not going to like. And I think BP is acutely aware that that could happen in a heartbeat.
Right.
I don't think they want to go, alienating the Obama administration here over this. Make no mistake about it. BP's survival as a company, as we have known it, is not assured here. I think there are clear risks that if BP doesn't play its cards right from here on out, life could get really bad for them. I mean, it's as if it's not bad enough now, but I mean, with enough contrition and sacrificial managerial firings and other do-gooder stuff, BP might muddle through this. But if they get stiff-necked, it's kind of how I read Tony Hayward today, all the lawyers in the world aren't going to save them from what's going to happen.
Well, the thing that shocked me was I had forgotten but realized a couple days ago that Stanley Sporkin is the BP America ombudsman. And the reason that shocked me is I can't think of any, Stanley Sporkin's reputation, because I know you know his history. He was general
all
counsel.
All honorable men. These are all honorable men.
He's about the least honorable guy. You know, Sporkin's genius is basically, putting the boot on ethical people while talking good government at the same time. So the idea that all the whistleblowers...
He's a dedicated public servant for his entire career, including his time as general counsel at the CIA. He was general counsel at the SEC, wasn't he?
Well, you have a Houston federal judge in the early 2000s on the record in their decision, saying that Sporkin had intentionally and knowingly filed a false affidavit with a court that convicted a guy who was innocent.
He was misinformed. That's a mistake. It happened.
No, actually, he initially tried to talk him out of it, so it was clear that he knew.
Well, this is the thing. This adds another dimension to this.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to get too spooky with this, but you have to realize you're dealing with entities here that are essentially elements of national security. When you're talking
right.
major oil companies, they're not like you and me.
they're threaded into the fractured kingdom of
exactly.
national
I mean,
security and intelligence agencies.
There's such an interwoven relationship between the oil majors and the government and the national security establishment. You can't even tell the bone from the marrow here. That's how these things work. So it's not surprising at all to me that you have Stanley Sporkin showing up as a BP ombudsman. Not surprising that you'd have Michael Bromwich showing up now to run the MMS. It's not surprising to me that you would have BP, one of the cheerleaders for cap and trade kind of stuff going on, which, as I put in the book, I think this whole greenhouse gas thing, cap and trade, all that stuff, it's all part of a bigger scenario here to try and move energy prices and energy costs higher, not not to clean up the environment, but to screw the Chinese, because
right.
they're the biggest buyers and needers of this stuff. We use it too, but we can afford it. The Chinese pay through the nose for it. They pay
right.
twice as much of their GDP for energy as we do. They need it to grow their economy. We've grown to the point where, you know, we're almost ambivalent about energy. It's not a big deal for us. It's not a life or death thing for our economy anymore, even.
But it's one of the few things we can trade back. It's the, you know, in the 1800s, it was opium, and now it's oil.
Yeah, I mean, we get oil from Canada, Mexico, the Saudis, our guys. The point I make in the book is that if you look at all of that as kind of our family, we're long on oil. We're net exporters, if you include those what amount to client or closely affiliated states as part of our orbit. We got plenty of oil. It's the Chinese who have to buy the stuff from strangers, ship it halfway around the world, and pay through the nose for it with an undervalued currency. So the whole cap and trade thing, to my view, it's so ludicrous on its face. The only way it makes sense is if there must be some kind of a geopolitical strategic agenda going on that would rationalize that some way. And you've got BP right out there leading the cheerleading on that, along with Shell. Even Exxon have bought into this thing. But to me, this is really a government-driven thing aimed at putting the onus on China for, you know, polluting the air.
Do we run the risk that the Gulf oil spill is going to be used to justify a cap-and-trade system?
That's already happened. In Obama's speech this week, that's what he was leading up to. He used the whole thing basically to justify a new energy bill that would include this cap-and-trade stuff, which, again, it's so economically ludicrous as to just be mind-boggling. And, in fact, it hasn't worked at all. You know, these credits already trade in Chicago on this, it's the CCX, I think. But if you look at what's happened, the value of these credits, they've gone through the floor. I mean, there's very little volume. They're worthless credits. And the whole idea that you're going to create value and trade it around, the Europeans have tried this. It's really gone nowhere. And I mean, the whole idea has stalled, especially in light of all of the fraudulent climate change.
Right, but you get enough government protection behind it, and then you've got a new derivatives market.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if the government wants to put enough muscle behind it, they'll drive it through one way or another. You know, and that's sort
right.
of what you see happening, I think.
That's not a good development.
No, but...
So what if you were living along the coastline of Louisiana, Alabama, Florida in the Panhandle, what would you do?
I would say I think about deeding my property to the Nature Conservancy and taking a tax write off for it or something. I don't know. I mean it's gonna be a mess down there for a while, although eventually they're going to fix it. I mean, look at Padre Island offshore Texas. You had
right.
tar coating the beaches down there for a long time in the early 80s from the
right.
Eastock thing. They cleaned it up. It's beautiful now. It's pristine. You know, the studies of the Eastock, that Mexican oil that blew out in 79 or so, they really can't find evidence of permanent damage to the environment. I mean, the fish come back. The critters come back. You know, eventually... the earth can kind of heal itself. And I think that's what will probably happen here. But not
okay, so one last question. What happens in hurricane season?
They're going to have to disconnect all those boats and head for the hills, and they're just going to let that well run for a while if they can't keep boats on station there. And then the oil will get spread around and dispersed and even more. And... maybe head to other places you didn't expect it to. But, yeah, I think they have to prepare for that. That's why they need to get this thing done quickly. But, you know, a hurricane comes along in August, that's going to screw up these relief wells big time. You have to move the rigs away, move them back, pick up where you left off drilling. It's a mess.
And what about shipping in the Gulf? Because... you're talking about, you know, a lot of the agricultural produce that we export comes out through the Mississippi and New Orleans and through the Gulf. What happens to the shipping?
Oh, I think that will move uninterrupted. I don't think that is a problem. I mean, there's a lot of boat traffic down there now, but that's, I think that's all manageable. They can keep the skimming away from the main shipping lanes.
Okay.
There's been concern about, like, the Louisiana offshore port, whether you could get crude tankers in there or not. But I haven't seen that as being so much a problem. The real problem is going to be a huge amount of underutilized offshore equipment that's going to sit there for 6 months, a year, maybe a year and a half. I mean, the people in the oilfield service industry, they're saying it's probably going to take 18 months for offshore activity to get back to even half what it was before this happened.
So how much has this cost Exxon and Shell? The other companies?
Exxon and Shell, I don't know. Well, look at it this way. Every well they drill offshore now, instead of costing, say, $60 million, probably cost them $100 million because the extra steel, the extra precautions, everything else you're going to put into it. They'll have better wells. They'll get their money's worth, I think, out of it. So to that extent, I think they'll get the value added from it. What the real losers, I think, are lesser companies who have invested in these deep water offshore leases. They don't have the ante to play out there anymore. There's a raft
right.
of those kind of companies. Even Anadarko, who is BP's 25% partner in this, the hit to their stock has even been worse than BP's percentage-wise.
So great, and more centralization.
Yeah, I mean, the big guys will get bigger. The little guys just won't be able to go there. The cost of entry will be too high. And these are the most prolific oil provinces out there now. One of the smartest moves that Larry Nichols ever made, he's the head of Devon Energy, it was six months or so ago, he decided to sell all of his deepwater Gulf of Mexico assets to BP. So he cashed out just in the nick of time. I think he could see that the risks were just beyond the size of even Devon, which is one of the largest independent companies. And in fact, what I think you're going to see is that even Exxon and Shell will need to get bigger in order to be able to self-insure the risks of drilling in these provinces now.
Right.
So that's another argument I would make for why basically you need to break up BP, put it with the big guys who know how to play this game. And there's no room for amateurs out there anymore.
Right.
BP has painfully exhibited itself to be an amateur player in this business. So,
Tracy. Jim, thank you so much. Now, how do we find you on the web?
I have a website. If you just look at theoilcard.com, I think you'll get connected with my publisher at least, and you can send me an email. All comments, criticisms, libel suits, you can send them that way, I suppose.
Okay.
Or they could contact you, and you can pass
I'll forward it.
Yeah.
I'll forward it. Well, thank you so much. You
a
have
pleasure.
A wonderful, wonderful evening. We appreciate it so much, Jim.
Thanks for having me on your show. Best wishes.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Coming up on July 1st, second quarter wrap-up, the movie, I'm going to change the movie. We're going to do Spartacus with Kirk Douglas. I really encourage you to watch it. It's one of my all-time favorites, so get a hold of Spartacus with Kirk Douglas. I'm sure you can get it at the video store. You can get it at Netflix. So it's the second quarter wrap-up. Then on July 8th, Precious Metals Market Report. I will be coming to you from London. Franklin Sanders will be coming to you from Tennessee. And James Turk, oddly enough, will be back in the United States, so he'll be coming in through New Hampshire. We're going to have James joining us to report on international developments in the precious metals market. And then on July 15th, at last, Bob Sullivan, MSNBC's reporter on consumer fraud, top expert in the country on identity theft, will be talking about identity theft. A reminder, the Clifford Carnicom interview transcript for the special interview with Clifford, Part 1, is up at the archive under next to that MP3. Get it? You have my permission to share it with family and friends. It's really an important one. So until July 1st, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.